So klingt Weihnachten bei Rewe. Jetzt festlich sparen bei deinem Weihnachtseinkauf. Diese Woche bei Rewe. Meine Lieblinge, Wildlachs in Scheiben, je 80 Gramm Packung oder Lachs in Scheiben, je 100 Gramm Packung, nur 3,29 Euro. Oder Le Rustique Camembert, französischer Weichkäse, je 250 Gramm Packung, nur 2,79 Euro. Festlich sparen bei Rewe. Dein Markt.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, U.S. Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey. With me, as always, my lovely co-host, Nadia Oxford.
Hello, everybody. Hope you're doing well. Hope it's nice where you are. It's cold where I am, and there's this awful wind. Otherwise, I'm good.
This is the first time in a while that we haven't had somebody else joining us. It's just the two of us today, Nadia.
Yeah, just the two of us and our cats, who don't really have much of an opinion on anything.
My cat has a lot of opinions on a lot of different things, I will have you know.
But he only knows how to express them as meow, so.
No, he expresses them in many different ways. If you want to learn how to speak cat, you have to learn how to understand body language and the way that they meow. And that, yeah, there is a language, there is a rhyme and a reason to it, but mostly he just stands there and goes, meow.
This is what I think of politics.
Yeah, so there's a big RPG coming out, I believe, this week as of the launch of this recording, and that is Ni No Kuni 2. I'm going to be talking about that. I'm also going to be talking about a game that sort of kind of wants to be an RPG, or at least co-ops RPG elements. It's a game that I saw last week, which is God of War. Oh, and a small side note, Nadia, I finally beat Monster Hunter World.
Yes, I saw on Twitter. Congratulations. Mazel tov.
Woohoo! Yes, thank you. Now I'm officially into the post-game, which consists entirely of grinding.
You thought you were grinding before. Now get ready for more grinding.
Even more grinding. Oh my gosh. I just want a really nice set of armor. I feel the impetus. I want that armor.
Is that feedback, that infamous Monster Hunter feedback. We were talking a little bit about Monster Hunter on the US Gamer podcast, and Mike was saying how whenever he needs help, he just kind of fires a flare and like three Japanese guys come and help him out. And they don't just like do it like, you know, like regularly. They just put on an incredible show, and it's just so much fun to watch.
I did a whole bunch of research, and I've finally found like the armor set that I want.
Which?
But well, I mean, it's not just a monster; it's multiple different parts. So it's like a Rathos Soul Helm Beta with the Rathian armor, with the Narragigante Coil, with the Death Stench Heal.
That sounds so badass. You should wear that to prom, Monster Hunter
and then,
prom.
How do you know I didn't? And then also the second powered Narragigante sword, because I don't have it in me to go through like 20 hours in the arena just to get like a plus 20 to my defense on a sword. I don't have it in me, but I do have it in me to fight the Narragigante 10 times so that I can smash its face in and get horns.
Yeah, that's fair. You never quite get tired of that, I suppose.
I don't know, it's just, it doesn't necessarily feel like a grind to me because every battle is so intense.
They really are, aren't they? Like, they never really get any less intense. I think maybe by the end of, like, when I was done farming the Great Jagras, I was just like, okay, let's just beat you up now. But other than that, like, some of the harder monsters, yeah, they never get less intense.
The Narragigante is especially very tough. We did earlier this week, we ranked the Monster Hunter World encounters by what a pain in the ass they are. Shockingly, Narragigante was number one, but there were a bunch of others, and maybe some that you weren't expecting. So go check that out on the site. Here and I collaborated on that one because I believe we're the furthest in Monster Hunter at this part. Once I get the armor set and the weapon that I want, it's on to fighting tempered versions of monsters that I've been fighting this entire game, which is to say they glow purple. or at least their icons are purple.
Okay.
And it just means they're stronger. I guess they have better stats and maybe different attacks and that kind of thing.
That's
and your
right.
goal And your goals, your sole goal is to eventually reach level 99 in Hunter rank.
And then what?
I mean, but also there's going to be, I guess, expansions and more monsters coming. Earlier this week, Capcom announced a whole new Monster Hunter World monster coming soon. And also the ability to redo your monsters, which is kind of nice.
Yeah. So I think, I don't know what it's called. Mike and I were talking about it, the Devil Joe, Devil Ho. We don't know, but it's
Devil Ho.
Devil Ho. It's coming.
Yeah.
Along with Dante.
Yeah, I have no idea. But like, yeah, I'm looking forward to fighting that. I'm looking forward to just jumping on and fighting these monsters, perhaps with friends. Bob and I talk all the time about Monster Hunter World, but for some reason we haven't played it together yet. So.
Oh, that's really interesting. He must be so happy to have you in the fold, though.
He's happy to have everybody in the fold.
I'll be getting back to it actually this weekend because I had to stop for a while. But I still have a vendetta against that stupid electric ferret lizard thing.
I stopped long enough to I had to stop to play Ni No Kuni 2, but I did manage to squeeze in the final boss battle, which is pretty cool. Like the final boss is gigantic and awesome and fun to fight. Not hard either. Very easy, actually.
Oh, really? So is that the one you did on the stream?
I think no, those were the Elder Dragons, who are a lot tougher and fairly tough to solo. Mm-hmm. And I had Hiren helping me out with those. There's like a melty zombie dragon and a fire dragon and a very generic metal dragon. but then after that, there's a super dragon who looks like a Pokemon.
I think I know the one you're talking about. Yeah. I've seen pictures of him.
Yes, he looks pretty rad, but he looks like a Pokemon. So
all the designs are pretty rad. I really like the designs. Mm.
I think that's the point. I wish there were more monsters, but the ones that are in there are so good that it's almost like, as long as I get some good expansions, it's fine.
Yeah.
But a game that is coming out in a month that I finally got to play on Friday, a game that, weirdly enough, has not been available as a hands-on experience, despite the fact that we've known about it for almost 2 years now, mm-hmm. God of War, a game that is not an RPG.
Nope.
It is a, I don't know, it's almost like a third-person shooter, melee shooter.
That's an interesting
thing. Does that make sense to you? Because the camera's...
Does he, like, throw his axe? And...
Yeah.
Okay, I can accept that.
Because the camera is pretty much fixed right over the shoulder. It's almost like Resident Evil 4.
Right, which was a great game.
And you can throw the axe that he has. He has this I think it's called the Leviathan axe, there will be enemies standing up on a wall, and you'll see them, and they'll be shooting at you. They'll be shooting fire rather than bullets or whatever.
Yeah.
So you will take your axe and throw it at them, and then maybe do some injury. And then you press triangle and call it back to you. That's almost fun. Like, it reminded me of Avengers, actually.
Oh, the Mjolnir.
Yeah, exactly. Like, all I could think of was, you guys are totally watching the Avengers, and you got this idea. I actually spent like 10 minutes or 15 minutes interviewing Corey Barlog about that, and he said that initially the axe combat was kind of like straightforward and linear, and mm-hmm. he kind of had the idea that it needed to be more interesting, and that involved actually throwing it at people standing on walls and that kind of thing. So
I can appreciate that. I can respect that. I mean, yeah, it's from Avengers, but it's one of the coolest things from Avengers.
Mm-hmm. It's I think the combat is actually pretty good for the
That's
most part.
Yeah.
Involves lots of rolling around, dealing with enemies coming at you from multiple sides. You hammer square so your son Atreus shoots them with arrows. And like he helps. He's helping.
I'm helping. His name sounds like Atreyu.
He is this kind of sullen kid with like sunken eyes who he's kind of undersized. Sounds like he wants to be a warrior, I guess, like Kratos, but he's like itty bitty.
Kind of reminds me a little bit of you love Redwall. You read Metameo, right? He kind of starts off as a brat, and he has to learn and grow as the book goes on, which is why it's one of my favorite Redwall books. So maybe it's
good. Yes. He's not a brat. He's very deferential to Kratos, who, like, sounds like a grizzly bear. He's got this like deep, deep growl. He's like, boy.
Boy,
like
here.
I can't even come close to.
That's what my deep voice is for. Boy, come yes. here.
Yeah, that's there. You go. That's exactly what Kratos sounds like.
Hire me.
Yes, we have the new voice of Kratos here. It's Nadia Oxford. So, God of War has God of War, like so many other AAA games these days, it has a skill tree. Nadia,
I love skill trees.
Totally co-opts the skill trees to add some semblance of death.
Nice.
And what? Let's see. Assassin's Creed Origins has them. Horizon Zero Dawn has them. This game has them. Mm-hmm. It's become a kind of a fixture of this sort of action game. And I'm wondering, what do you think of the fact that these games have been co-opting this element that we know so well from RPGs?
I'm okay with it. I mean, let's face it, RPGs have been kind of co-opting each other for a very long time. I mean, look at Dragon Quest kind of co-opting Wizardry and just kind of build from there. So if you have adventure games co-opting skill trees to give it a little bit more depth, I'm okay with that. I even if it only gives you a little bit of customization, I find it's fun. I find that one of the funnest things about playing games like that. Like, for example, Skyrim is talking about, I know Skyrim's an actual RPG, but in any case, I just like talking about character builds. Like, what did you do? Oh, I was an Argonian archer. I can never get away from that build, FYI. So I'm okay with it. I'm someone who believes, like, we can all benefit from each other.
What's funny about skill trees is that skill trees didn't even start with RPGs. It's an idea that David Brevik pulled from strategy games.
Oh, well, there you go.
He pulled the idea of basically a tech tree from, like, Civilization.
Oh, interesting.
And implemented it into Diablo. Mm-hmm. And consequently, we now think of skill trees as an RPG thing.
Yes. Oh, goodness gracious, you're right.
I think my issue with skill trees in these games is that often they're really shallow.
Yeah, they definitely are.
One of the problems with them is that you will have a one true path in terms of just leveling up your character. Because you're not really having quote-unquote builds. You're just unlocking attacks. It's a way to gate the progression, right? And so it's like, oh, I have just unlocked this totally overpowered attack. Sweet. I'm just, what particular element of my character do I want to be overpowered?
That's a good point, yeah.
It's never really stood up to me as like anything particularly interesting. I think Horizon Zero Dawn was a really good example of just like how banal a skill tree can actually be. It felt like a lot of the skills didn't, like, either they were overpowered or they didn't do anything.
Some people will disagree with you on that one, I'm sure.
Yeah. Assassin's Creed Origins, I think, did the skill tree a bit better. God of War, the way that its skill tree works is that, so you've got shield attacks. And then you have your axe. And you have your kid. You can level your kid up, too.
Nice. Throw your kid at the enemies.
You should be able to do that, right?
Come on.
Yeah. One of the things that I kind of like about God of War is that you throw the axe, and then when the axe is, like, gone, you spend a lot of time, like, punching people in the face. And it feels just as good to just punch somebody while using the shield as it does to actually use the axe. So what you'll end up doing is you'll be swiping with the axe, you'll be doing area of effect attacks and that kind of thing. You'll see somebody up on a ridge, you'll throw the axe, and then you'll like turn around and you'll start punching people in the face.
Nice.
And if you punch people in the face long enough, you'll get the indicator that you can, you know, do a finishing move essentially. Which involves like Kratos stomping their face in or ripping them apart or picking them up and throwing them at somebody or picking them up and throwing them off a cliff.
Sure. Go fly.
Yes, I can believe I can fly.
No, you can't.
Oh.
But I do like the idea of like him throwing the axe and like just waiting for it to come back, and maybe like you hear Spanish Flea playing in the background while you're waiting and punching people. Like you're waiting for
is this an Avengers reference? Am I missing something?
No, it's just whenever you're waiting around for stuff to happen, I just think of Spanish Flea playing in the background.
Yeah, I don't know if I have much else to say about God of War, actually. It struck me that it's like, oh, look, another action game that has a skill tree.
Right.
This is very much a thing. Gotcha.
Yeah, it sounds to me like it'll be fun to play. Like, it sounds like the combat is satisfying, which is, I'm okay with that. Combat satisfying. You probably get a weepy story with Kratos and his kid. Done in 20 hours. Probably won't think about it again for the rest of the year, but I'll probably have fun with it by the sounds of it.
It's more like 40 hours.
Oh, God, that's right. They really kind of beefed that up, didn't they?
And Corey Barlog is an auteur. He wants to tell a story. And you can see it in the game, too. Like, there's this one moment where you see the kids sitting in the house, and then the camera whips around, and you see Kratos menacingly framed in the door frame, with shadow following over him. It's like, oh, look at this lighting. It's so dramatic.
You got dramatic lighting, people.
Probably the most interesting thing about this game is that it's all, quote-unquote, one take. So they don't have loading screens. They don't have any cuts. It's just all one, like, thing. It's all in engine, complete flow, no anything. I think that's actually a pretty cool, like, technical achievement. And
I do too,
It's really interesting that... I wonder if this is the direction that action games just go from in the future. No loading screens, nothing to interrupt it, as it were.
That's actually not a bad idea, because actually I had just reviewed Kirby, and although I did enjoy the game quite
Kirby.
A bit, there were a lot of like stops and load screens, because it still kind of follows that old-fashioned Kirby formula where you enter a door, and then you're in another area, and you enter another door, and that's your bonus room. So you always have that little pause in between, and I don't think action games really need that very much. A+.
God of War also has a crafting system. Surprising no one. You can install items into his axe that will power them up. You can get better armor, and when you get better armor, the armor on Kratos actually changes.
That's cool. I was actually about to ask you that.
Yep. So, I mean, that looks pretty cool. It went from his heavy kind of bog standard Kratos armor. No, it's more like furs. He looked like, I mentioned that he looked like a grizzly bear. Like, he's wearing furs in this game.
Well, he is up in the northern, like, sort of Nordic lands. I don't blame him.
He ended up in Scandahoovia.
Scandahoovia?
Oh, yeah. Now Kratos is going to move to Minnesota, don't you know?
The weather's
Kratos deals with Minnesota nice. Roar! Stop being so passive-aggressive.
Yeah, that would drive him crazy. Oh, now you just settle down there, Mr. Kratos. You have to wait your turn like everyone else for your coffee.
Oh,
no, Kratos.
I will destroy you. No, I would pay good money for Kratos in Minnesota.
I would pay to see, like, Fargo with Kratos in, like, as a guest star.
Yeah, no. Bear armor to kind of like this thin, almost Nordic armor. Mm-hmm. Actually, it looks a little like something you might see in Lord of the Rings.
Right.
Yeah, so. Yeah, that's God of War, a game that I will probably play. I don't know that I would quote-unquote say that I'm excited for it, but it is a game that exists.
It's one of those games. It exists. That's your tagline.
And a game that will undoubtedly sell like 10 million copies and will probably appear on a number of top 20 lists. And it's going to be a franchise.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I care.
I was never a fan of the original God of War. I always found it way too, like, not really hyper-masculine, but just very edgy, I guess, like, violent for the sake of being violent.
It was so edgelord. Oh my God.
It was very edgelord. I was never impressed by it, and some of the violence was kind of impressive and like, holy hell, that's kind of cool the way you thought of doing that. But in other times, it's like, okay, I'm kind of tired of this fighting and, you know, screwing everything you see, and I think I'm checking out now.
I was a fan of the original God of War.
Oh, really?
I also played God of War 2.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought that God of War 1 could have just stood on its own. It was a very tidy little arc about one man's quest for revenge. It ends up in a really, it opens in a really cool way, like Kratos throwing himself off a cliff. That's kind of neat.
Yeah.
I liked his quest for revenge against Ares. I liked his tragic backstory. Yes, it involved like a dead family, whatever. But I mean, back in 2005, there was like real pathos there, and it felt like he was actually on a redemption arc, right?
Yeah, that is true. And for the time, it was like, it was quite unique.
Then he sits on the throne. He's the god of war. You get a triumphant montage, and it literally is like, and from that time forward, Kratos was the god of war, and he watched over all the soldiers, and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh, great ending. Yeah.
So he's a saint of killers.
And then in the next game, he's an asshole. Like, the biggest asshole ever. Like, they completely derailed his character in God of War 2.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He comes out, and he's just like, I'm a big stompy bastard. I'm going to destroy the Colossus of Rhodes because I'm a jerk. My armies are running riot. And the gods are all like, calm down, Kratos. Jeez, stop being such a jerk. He's like, no, I'm Kratos. I will kill you. Grr. And then they depower him, and he's like, now you're really dead. And he goes and teams up with the Titans, and he's like, the gods were mean. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I was breaking everything and being a total jerk, but they were really mean to me.
They're mean to me, and it kicks his heels, and the Titans hate the gods, so they're just, like, itching for any chance to screw them up.
And then by God of War 3, he comes right back, and he kills every one of them, and he's just so irredeemable. He is so awful and bad and horrible that you're like, I can't root for you.
Exactly.
And screw the redemption arc. Like, they were trying to be like, oh, but Kratos is still sad about his family in God of War 3. But
you're killing everyone because you're sad about your family. I hate that.
You brought this on yourself, you jerk.
I hate stories that do that.
But in God of War 1, that it actually made sense because, like, he had an actual motive because Ares manipulated him, made him an unstoppable killing machine, and then he accidentally kills his family. That's sad. Okay, that's tragedy.
Right,
that's,
and it kind of calls back to the myth of Hercules.
And the first time I played, when I played God of War, and I found Kratos being such an awful, over-the-top person hilarious, because I had never really seen a villain, a protagonist like this. Like,
true.
When he takes a guy who gives him the thing that he needs, and he's like, no, I'm going to kill you, and throws him down the mouth of the Hydra. That's funny. That was funny. Yeah. That's God of War, which is coming out next month, and I'm sure that we will have things to say about it.
Yes, we will.
But moving on, let's talk about a game that our audience really actually does care about, which is not God of War, is Ni no Kuni 2, another sequel, a game that by the time you hear this podcast, my review will be up. I will have finished the game. I have been playing it. It's actually shorter than you would think, Nadia.
Okay, that's good, because I've been playing like 10 million 100-hour RPGs, and sometimes you just need one that's a little bit saner.
I think it's closer to more like 35.
Wow.
30, 35, maybe 40 at the outside.
Yeah, that's the like the olden days back in the SNES. That's pretty much what you could expect.
I think most of the kind of the elements that bulk out the story are grinding to level up your castle. Which you unlock in like chapter 4. The castle, as you're going to see in my review, it plays a large role in this story, Nadia. And it's actually my favorite part of the game.
Okay, yeah, because I really liked the castle in Suikoden 2, so I hope it's a bit like that, where you build it up and you have people who move in and make trouble and just have a good time.
Yeah, so this is what I'm going to say about Ni no Kuni 2. Without the castle, I think it would be average at best. It's okay.
Right, yeah.
I don't think there's anything especially remarkable about it. It's very, very treacly cute.
Yes, it is. I mean,
it's like a fairy tale.
What's the name of the isn't there someone named like Mr. Whiskerbottom or something like that? Like,
you mean Evan Pettywhisker?
That's
the main
Evan
character.
Come on, that's like what you name your cat when you're being sarcastic.
He also has a cute little mascot,
of course,
that follows him around, who's his kingmaker. Can I talk about how weird the politics are in Ni no Kuni 2 real quick?
Well, if we're talking about a game where a Mr. Pettywhiskers is like involved in politics, sure, you may as well.
I mean, we've already talked about Babar.
Yes.
But so the main idea behind the game, of course, is that a kid is over, like, Evan's dad is killed in a coup.
Okay.
And so Evan's driven out of his castle, and he resolves to start his own new kingdom with hookers.
Hookers and blow, yes.
And blow.
And black.
Screw the kingdom. And he teams up with a guy named Roland, who is from, well, kind of our universe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He's and it's established early on, like, where he's come from. And it's actually kind of messed up. And I'm not allowed to talk about it, which is super annoying. But it's kind of messed up how he gets over here. Or over there, I suppose. And those are the two main characters, and they're the only characters that matter,
mm-hmm.
really. There are other characters, but they're, like, totally incidental.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the girl who's, like, the sky pirate, she doesn't matter at all.
Oh, that's too bad. I saw her, and there was, like, some footage or some demo footage or something where she featured, and she seemed kind of cool.
So Evan Pettywhisker's main goal is to build a new kingdom, which he accomplishes by going around and asking people to come live in his kingdom.
Just like the old kings of old.
And he wants to unite the world. Like, there won't be any war if I run everything.
Oh, God.
He's taking over the world. He's the world's most, like, insidious supervillain.
Isn't this usually what, like, villains do, like, of all RPGs? Like, I'm going to unite the world. No, you know you're not. You can't take away individual thought. Yes, I can.
So he goes around to these kingdoms, and he's basically like, I did you a favor. Will you sign my Declaration of Interdependence and join me?
Wow.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's, like, most of the plot. That's, like, most of the plot is a lot of going around to these kingdoms, doing them a solid, and having them join in a union with you.
I changed your tire. Can you join my kingdom, please?
It's kind of put forward like the United Federation of Planets.
Uh-huh.
But really, Evan runs everything.
Yeah, by the sounds of it.
There's another weird element of this is you're recruiting these people into your castle, and then you go, welcome to Evermore. What will your job be? You're going to work in the mines.
You don't get to, like...
Welcome.
Sorry, he says, welcome to my castle. What job do you want? And then I guess presumably the people say, okay, I'll do this. No, you won't. You're going to work in the mines?
Yeah. No, you assign them their role.
Wow, that's as Orwellian as hell.
And then meanwhile, most of the time, Evan is sitting there in his, like, extremely fancy castle hall sipping tea with his little boyfriend. And... No, looking pretty as can be, and I'm just like, man, this game's classes to sell.
I'm just thinking of, like, that scene in Conker where, like, Conker's on the throne drinking beer, like, leering over everything, and just the world's under his foot.
It's like Evan Pettywhisker's like, we're all going to work together to build a wonderful kingdom, and it's going to be great, except I run everything, and I owe everything, and you owe me everything.
I sit on my ass and drink tea. Do they explore this? At all?
No.
Wow.
You keep coming back to your castle, and it's like, the people are working very hard for you. They're giving you their money.
Oh my
all
God.
Their money and all the materials. I'm like, gimme. I need
okay,
to keep...
I am 100% down with Cult Sim 2018.
And you keep reinvesting into your castle, right?
Right.
And building it up and building it up. But of course, the castle is the biggest, because the castle's got to be the biggest.
Of course. You can't live with the commoners. You kidding me?
It just goes to show, by the way, how screwed up our politics are today, that my immediate thought was, Evan Pettywhisker's a globalist.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the other thing I kept thinking was, when the revolution comes, Evan Pettywhisker will be the first against the wall.
First up against the wall. Get up against the wall! Oh no, this is terrible!
It's so weird playing this game, especially, like, okay, I get it, it's a fairy tale, right?
Right.
A fairy tale where, like, these characters are all coming together, and as long as the monarch loves their people and wants to do the best by the kingdom, everything's going to be great.
It's so weird, because, like, okay, that's fine for a children's book that's maybe 10 pages long, but not for an RPG that's 40 hours long.
This is basically a kid's book.
Yeah.
It's very Saturday morning cartoon with its, like, evil villains and, you know, evil with a capital E.
Of course.
And everybody wants to basically help one another out, and they're working in their best interest, and there's not really any politics in this.
Of course not.
There are, yeah. So it's cute in that way. It's a throwback. But I just found myself kind of cackling at how far you can really take its view on, like, establishing a good government. Don't even get me started on what Evan's kids are probably going to be like. So what I'm saying basically is that actual monarchies never work out in the long term, because the kids always, there's always going to be a kid, or there's always going to be a succession of power. And yes. When Evan inevitably dies, the rat people are going to show up and take over his kingdom, and all will be darkness. So what I'm saying is that Ni No Kuni 2 can never have a happy ending.
Glory to the rat people.
So now that I've ruined your RPG for you, it's not tedious.
Yeah.
But the battle system looks like it has a lot of systems going on, right? So, but what it really amounts to is if you got strong gear, you're good. Right. It's all fine. Like, just keep leveling up that gear and you're okay. And you do that by, you know, just going to the shops and buying it. And that's typical RPG trope. That's totally cool.
Right.
But it's a lot simpler than it ultimately looks as an action RPG goes. Because, like, the battles take, like, a minute. Mm-hmm. To, like, less than a minute. Like, maybe 15 seconds to complete if you're geared up properly. Totally cool. The Higgledies don't actually matter that much.
Are those the little guys that follow you around?
The little sprites, yeah. I was kind of surprised at, like, I kept waiting for it to get a lot more elaborate, and it never did.
Right.
So you can get additional Higgledies, you can cook them up, you can nurture them. I didn't really have a strong feel for how much stronger they were when you actually leveled them up. So I didn't put a lot of emphasis on that. I did level them up. Mm-hmm. I guess it makes their attack stronger. They have these little abilities, and I think that's where their main value is. They have these little abilities that will help out your party, like they'll heal you, or they will do a little bit of healing, or they will, like, give you some buffs.
Right.
But often you're chewing through random encounters so quickly that, like, you barely even notice them.
Right.
It's much more about the elemental skills on your swords and that kind of thing. Right. So, yeah. So yeah, the combat is actually simpler than it looks. You got this tactics tuner, and you twist the little knobs, and you're like, oh, I want to do more damage to fairy type enemies as opposed to slime type enemies,
okay,
or I want to mess around with the drops. I want to do more damage with my strong attacks, or I want to build up my MP more quickly.
Right.
Like, there are some interesting choices to be made with the tactics tuner, but I don't think it really matters that much.
Is there any sort of difficulty adjustment?
No, there's no difficulty adjuster.
That's
like,
a little too bad.
You're thinking the world ends with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, what it comes down to is buy the best gear, you're set. So, and then when you're fighting bosses, like, the bosses are a little more involved, because the Higgledies are involved, are a lot more involved in that case. Often when you're fighting the big bosses, like the big bosses, they will have their own specific Higgledies that you have to take advantage of in some way. Like, either they'll be shooting tons of cannons at a boss, or they will block fire attacks, or they will even become a turret that you use to knock off the armor of a boss.
Oh, that's kind
of
cool.
The boss fights are okay.
Right.
They're not too bad. Pretty much every major quest follows the same loop.
Right.
Oh, the monarch of this kingdom is being controlled. Now you must go into a dungeon and solve some traversal puzzles.
And then
you now you fight
him.
The big boss, and everything's good. Yay! And it keeps hitting this loop repeatedly.
Right.
The thing that I found the most interesting about it, as I said, was a castle. I thought it was executed really well. So
what do you do for
here's
that?
One of my big problems with castles, okay? You often don't have reason to go back to them.
Right. Yeah, like, you just kind of, like, leave everyone to their own devices while you're exploring. And that's why I mentioned Suikoden 2, because that was a fun castle to go back to.
What was Suikoden 2's castle like? I don't remember it very well. What was so special about its castle?
Well, for one thing, you had the cooking contest, which some people think is the best part of the game. And it was just a good place to get things done. Like, I remember you could recruit a detective, and you could get the detective to search more info about your characters. And of course, there's 108 of them, so he would like always come back with different info for you. You would just kind of see them, your characters hanging out. Like, I remember when I got the unicorn, Siegfried, he'd just kind of hang out drinking from the the pond at front. And I'm like, hey, unicorn, how's it going? So you would just kind of, like, find the characters, see what they're up to. And, you know, they'd be hanging out at the bar or whatever. Like, it's a very homey sort of place. And you kind of see laundry drying on the lines. It was neat.
Ni no Kuni 2 doesn't really have that element to it. Like, it doesn't have a cooking contest.
Ooh.
What it does have is, you build up the shops. The shops give you stuff. You periodically, interestingly, it does kind of a mobile gaming type thing where you automatically earn money from the hard-earned taxes of the proletariat who are working or toiling beneath you. You take their taxes, you take their materials, and you can use that to build up more stuff for your castle. And you can level up you can periodically level up the castle and make it bigger. And it's a good reflection of the progress that you're making. You can also pick up side quests by walking around the castle and talking to people. Mm-hmm. And when I say walking around the town, I mean that it shifts to the overworld perspective, and you got the little Cupid doll, Evan.
Right.
Which, by the way, that overworld has, what the heck? It's like they imported it straight from the PS2.
Yeah.
What were they even thinking about that?
It's like, okay, did you guys run out of time? What happened there? That's a little bit weird.
It feels like a stylistic choice.
Yeah, which is very strange.
It feels like they had a certain budget, and this is just pure speculation on my part. They had a certain budget, and they wanted to do a lot with this game, but they could only do so much.
Of course, yeah.
So they went for a style that was deliberately simplistic to be able to do it. And frankly, I don't want to say that it ruins the game, because it doesn't, but the contrast is so jarring
it
drags down the graphics as a whole.
Right, because I've seen the battle scenes and whatnot, and they look fantastic, and then you go to this PS2 era, as you explained it, and it just doesn't really balance each other out very well, does it?
At one point, you're flying around in an airship.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it seriously looks like an early PS2 game when you're looking at the mountains and everything. Not a ton of pop-in. It's just the textures are so simple.
Yeah, simplistic, I suppose. Not much in the way of detail.
I would even go as far as to say that a lot of PS2 games look better. This is like a...
Ouch.
This is not like, Final Fantasy X was trying to be as good as possible, and now it's outdated. No, I'm saying, like, it looked like a mid-budget PS2 game in HD.
Fantastic.
In HD. So I'm just like... And then, worse, they accentuate it with this strategy layer, which I don't understand why. I get it. Like, they want to impress upon you that Evan Pettywhisker has an army.
Mm-hmm.
It ties into the whole becoming a king and rising to become, like, to own the world or something. But it also is in this same kind of PS2 overworld type thing.
I saw that.
So it spends a lot of time. I spent a lot of time staring at the ugliest part of the game.
Yeah, no one wants to do that. That is very jarring.
It's just a strange idea, I think. So I think when you take it together, it's executed competently. It's reasonably fun to play. I found myself, I didn't hate it, I suppose. But I don't see a ton of merit in it. I don't think there's anything that truly rises above, except maybe the castle element.
Right. Right. And, of course, PlayStation 4, let's face it, has some really excellent RPGs. We're not exactly in an era where we're starved for JRPGs anymore.
Yeah, that's a problem for it, right? It's not 2011 anymore.
No.
I would say that this is a solid B tier, maybe B minus tier RPG.
Mm-hmm.
And Jason Schreier really seems up on this game, and I'm trying to figure out why.
I don't want to speak negatively.
I don't want to impugn the reputation of Jason Schreier.
No, but he also hated Xenoblade Chronicles 2, which I adored, so I am taking all of his
not salt. Enough people are talking about Ni No Kuni 2. I'm excited to see his review. Mm-hmm. And I may even be in the minority on this one, because you know me, Miss. Oh, I would rather play Monster Hunter.
No,
I'm a systems-based gal, whatever, but what am I missing here?
No, I think going by what you're saying, I still want to play it, because it sounds like a very cute sort of little RPG, but not one that would really make my best of the year list at the end of the day, but not necessarily a game you'd regret spending time with, but just nothing really overly remarkable, and I'm kind of surprised that Schreier's not looking at the story for this thing and saying, this is weird.
What itch does this scratch?
That's a good way to describe, like, why would you play an RPG?
If you want really cute anime style RPG that's kind of in the classical style of the PS2, I would play a Tales game.
Right.
I would play Tales of Berseria, for example, before I played this. If you're looking for something that's kind of like Dragon Quest, but an action RPG, I guess it kind of scratches that itch a little bit. I think it is misleading to suggest, and I'm not saying that Jason Schreier is doing this. I do think it's misleading to compare this to Suikoden 2, because I don't think they have anything in common.
Right, like the way you're describing the castle versus like what the castle is in Suikoden 2, it doesn't sound very much alike at all.
Right, and in Suikoden 2, when you're recruiting people, they are party members who are,
yes,
you know, part of, like, you can have them in infinite permutations. Yes. And in this game, when you're recruiting people, you go and do a side quest, and it's like a fetch quest. So it's like, oh, get 5 of the thing, deliver it. Oh, you got a new person.
Yay.
or go kill a bonus monster.
Right.
And, oh, look, now they joined, they've come on in, and they've been sent to the mines.
Under the castle.
Under the castle with you, into the fields.
Potato buddy.
The little sky pirate girl, who's ostensibly a character, but I don't think she has any arc outside of her main quest.
Mm-hmm.
She went right to the mines.
Oh no, but she belongs in the sky.
Into the mines with you.
Oh dear.
Yeah, like, yeah, you get additional party members, but they do not have arcs outside of their main quest line.
Right, that's too bad.
Yeah, no, Roland and Evan, and maybe a little bit of another character that you ultimately end up recruiting. Meh. It's all about Evan and Roland.
It's all about Evan and the great benevolent nation that he's building.
I think the most fun I had with this game was just building up the castle. You can get some really good gear out of building up that castle. You definitely want to build up the castle.
Right.
Build up the castle if you play this game. Get the weapons, get the outfitter, get them up to the maximum level, because you'll get really good weapons out of it, and then you can also progressively power them up, and that's right. How you succeed in this game. Also, there's an XP thing, and if you don't make use of that, if you don't make use of the XP boosts, you're going to become underleveled pretty fast.
Right. That's good to know.
And if you're underleveled in this game, it doesn't matter how much you manipulate the tactics tuner or how good your Higgledies are or whatever, you're going to get rolled. You are going to get face rolled.
Right.
And that's just how it is. So, yeah, it's all about just gear. Like I said, which is not inherently a bad thing. I'm just saying that the tactics, I think, are a little superfluous.
Right.
How badly was I kind of ripped this game apart, didn't I?
No, I don't think so. Like I said, I still want to play it, but you're not kind of blowing up my expectations or anything. Like, I totally agree with you on the visuals, because I have seen them, and I have seen that switch, and I was kind of like, what the hell? That is so weird. Why would you do that? The story sounds fun to work through, but really weird, like, that it doesn't really consider how evil it technically is.
Well, it's like I don't know if it's evil. It's just weird.
Yeah.
It's fairy tale land.
Yeah, but it's still a weird basis for a 40-hour RPG to not kind of explore itself a little bit further. Masturbation joke goes here.
And well, in this world, you do live happily ever after.
Mm-hmm.
And you have these little animal characters. It's very fairy tale. It's very storybook, which is not a which is not necessarily a bad thing to have in an RPG like this. Like, it's very sweet. It's very cute.
Right.
But there's even a guy. Did you ever watch G.I. Joe?
A little bit, yeah.
Do you? So there was Cobra Commander.
Yes.
But then there was like this Emperor guy.
Was that Serpentor?
That might have been his name. Yeah, he had like this big. He had the big cobra thing.
That was Serpentor.
The main villain looks just like him.
And
he has the like the he has the whole cobra getup and everything.
Oh my god! Does he go around yelling cobra la 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 la? Because I think that was a stupid freaking battle cry, and everyone still laughs at it.
I didn't know he did that. I just know that this was the guy. Yeah. So yeah. So that's Ni No Kuni 2, a game that
is G.I. Joe.
I'm not going to recommend it.
Oh, that's a spicy take for the week right there.
I'm going to ultimately give it a 3.5 out of 5.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly because of the castle.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say, like, this is a game you got to buy.
Right.
Like, this is the RPG you got to play.
Right.
I think that there are lots of really good RPGs out there. And I think this game struggles to differentiate itself from them in
right.
a really meaningful way. It's above average.
Okay, yeah. It sounds like if you have nothing else, like if you are done, like every other RPG in the PS4's library, that's like a 4 or 5 by all means. But otherwise, take a pass for a while.
I know that there's going to be people in the comments who are like, well, I'm going to buy it anyway, because this is just a kind of sweet little RPG that I've been looking for, and I'm going to enjoy it. Godspeed to you. I bet you really will enjoy it.
Yeah,
I bet you'll go, this is great. The world is like fun and well realized, and like there are cute little characters everywhere, and I don't even care about how bizarre the politics are, and I don't care that the overworld looks kind of weird and the battle system isn't actually that great. Yeah, I'm just going to enjoy it. And with that, let's move on to reader mail. All right, Nadia, last week we talked up Xenoblade Chronicles 2 with Anthony Agnello, and the people responded. Wellman Second says, as someone who took 125 hours to beat Xenoblade Chronicles 2 and has a play clock of nearly 400 without even sniffing New Game Plus yet, just grinding for rare blade cards, trying to get Cosmos, Ursula's awful quest, and trying to take out super bosses, I can definitely say it is a great but flawed game, just like the other Xeno titles.
Mm-hmm.
So are you trying to fight the super bosses, Nadia?
Oh, God, no. There's actually one fantastic super boss that I ran into by accident, and I really love the way it's introduced. Basically, there is one of the continents is called Genbu, that's basically the name of the titan that it's on. And this is a really cold, snowy, dark sort of titan, and you find out why. But once in a while, the weather changes, and it becomes foggy. And when it becomes foggy, these literal Lovecraftian horrors come out. And it is actually kind of freaky, because we're talking about, like, you'll see an enemy over here who's like, oh, level 40, and then all of a sudden, King Monster with, like, 20 tentacles is, like, level 150. There's your super boss. Don't piss it off. So I just really like the way that that one was introduced, but most of the super bosses I am not at all strong enough to take on, even though I have 200 hours under my belt.
You know what RPG is way better than Ni No Kuni 2?
Xenoblade Chronicles 2?
Oh, yeah. That game is so much better. I would put another 40, 50 hours into Xenoblade Chronicles 2 before I play Ni No Kuni 2 for 40.
If nothing else, from what you've told me, just the world of Xenoblade Chronicles 2, for all the game's flaws, is just so interesting, and the atmosphere is so good. Like, the way I just described the super boss that they introduce, that still freaks me out.
And that's just a really good example of how the mechanics actually all play into each other really well.
Yes.
As opposed to, you have these mechanics that are there to accentuate the gameplay, but ultimately maybe don't matter in the grand scheme of things.
No.
So. Ryder Kicker said, I wonder if Kat collaborate on how people spend so many hours on sports games, which she has said are RPGs that come out every year. People have fun with the main gameplay battle mechanics, but they stay addicted because of the many other modes, including a build a character and manage a league and such, though that may be in the archives. Yeah, I have put a couple of hundred hours into sports games in the past, and that's pretty much what Ryder Kicker was saying, is that there's always some new mode. There's always some mode that grabs people, whether it's grinding up cards and building the quote-unquote ultimate team, right, or role-playing in a league. I've done that too. Or building up a character and trying to make them into a super-duper star. And if you get really sucked into a game, I played six full seasons of FIFA 15, I think it was, where my main goal was to win. It's called a treble. You win three different trophies in a single season.
Wow.
And my goal was to do that without restarting a single game. And I did it, damn nice. It. I built a kick-ass team, and I totally managed to do that. And
there you go. There's your super boss.
Yeah, it was one of my one of the most rewarding sports game, or one of the best gaming experiences I've ever had. The problem is that I'm now totally burned on a FIFA.
I was wondering, I'm like, wait a minute, like, not to say you don't play FIFA, but you don't talk about it nearly as much as you talk about, like, you know, Madden and whatnot.
Madden is because I play with other people. FIFA doesn't have online leagues, is the problem.
Really?
FIFA is all about the ultimate teams, which is just grinding. So much grinding. All of the grinding.
That's what Tom's really into, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, I like FIFA, too. Because when you're playing with somebody on the couch, that's the one of the best possible gaming experiences that you can have. But the main basic online experiences, and why the hell am I talking about this? Let's keep moving on. Hulu has a very long thing about Radiant Historia, a perfect chronology, which boils down to they disagree with Anthony's take on the battle system. They do think that it actually gets more interesting as time goes on. Mm-hmm. And it does not appear, they don't like the ending.
Right, yeah. I saw that big, long comment about the ending. I'm like, I'm not going to read this just yet because I'm still playing the game, so I don't want to be spoiled.
And TV's Adam says, I'm trying to open my heart and mind sufficiently to embrace the idea that someone could consider Arden to be a better villain than Kefka. It's not going great.
Yeah.
Do you see, like, way more of Arden in the DLC? Because I've only played the base game and found him to be so thinly characterized as to be more on par with, say, Ultimisia.
Interesting combination. Interesting comparison.
I think that's a fair take, to be perfectly honest. I like Arden, though. I think the thing is, Arden is kind of like the Joker, right? He's just kind of following you around. He always seems to be one step ahead of you at all times. He's just messing around with you.
He's got weird hair.
Yeah. I mean, he looks cool. If you're playing it in Japanese, he has a great voice actor.
Oh, that's good to know. Because I didn't dislike his voice actor by any means in English, but...
That's the thing I should mention. Ni no Kuni 2 does let you play in Japanese, which is great.
Should you? Like, did you...
Yes.
Okay. So you played the English
voices? But I always say that. I mean, the English voices are fine, actually.
Okay.
It's not... The English voices aren't bad at all.
I always give them a chance, so I'll probably do that.
Yes, it is a perfectly inoffensive RPG. I also have the music stuck in my head now.
Is it good?
It's okay. It's just like the rest of the game.
Okay.
Just like the rest of the game, it's perfectly okay.
It won't kill you.
Yeah, this game is so going to be hit and miss. I bet there are going to be people who call this their game of the year.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, it's okay. Why do you like this game so much? And on that note, after a solid hour of crapping all over Ni no Kuni 2.
Well, we spent half an hour on God of War, you know.
Axe of the Blood God is a U.S. Gamer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts are sold. Do us a favor. Leave us a review. Please don't complain about the fact that we just crapped all over Ni no Kuni 2. Leave us a serious review and tell us how great we are, because we love hearing how great we are.
Don't criticize us, but tell us how great we are. That's okay.
Yeah, we want to hear... Let me put it this way. If you like the show, leave a review. We'd love to hear from you.
That's
and by the way, if you want to have your comment left on the show, there are the show notes on the official website, or just send us an email at usgamer@usgamer.net. Which, by the way, if you send us like a 50-paragraph mail, we enjoy reading them, but we won't necessarily read them on the show because they're kind of long, as it were.
We do appreciate that you want to take that time to write to us, though, so thank you.
I think Writer Kicker has mastered the art of the interesting in-depth comment that is nevertheless short enough for me to actually read on the show.
Yes, so good job on that. If you want to see...
Good job, Writer Kicker.
Take a look at his work to get an idea of what to do. Copy.
Follow us on all of the social medias. That would be Twitter, Facebook, Twitch, that kind of thing, also go to usgamer.net. That's usgamer.net all the way around. And Nadia's at Nadia Oxford. I'm at the underscore catbot. Next week is going to be GDC week.
Woo.
It's going to be extremely busy, but we'll be back, as always, to record another episode of Axe the Blood God, probably to recap GDC. And I am hella busy. Once I finish this, I have to finish up my Ni No Kuni 2 review and all of my God of War preview stuff, and oh my god, just kill me now. But until then, for Nadia and myself, thanks for listening. Until next time, happy adventuring.
Persil sorgt schon seit 1907 für tiefenreine Wäsche, auch bei den Johnsons, oder Anna?
Das stimmt. Sogar meine Oma hat schon mit Persil gewaschen.
Und als Dankeschön für über 100 Jahre Vertrauen gibt's jetzt bis zu 15 Euro Rabatt auf unser Bestes.
Das mit der roten Schleife.
Genau, made in Germany. Mehr Infos auf unserbestes.persil.de.
Wenn es tiefenrein ist, ist es Persil. Unser